Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music about Tyrannosaurus chicken? Y'all like tea chicken? From Fort Smith, Arkansas, critically acclaimed duo Tyrannosaurus Chicken's Delta Blues is primal and progressive, foreign and familiar, abrasively gritty and technically brilliant, something akin to pure white lightning moonshine. They have CDs and merchandise for sale after the show, and more can be found at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Maxine's Tap Room in beautiful downtown Fayetteville, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. What do y'all think about our set back here? Do y'all like our set? These Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture of our esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox and are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our writers are all from the Fayetteville area, and their stories are all about unforeseen circumstances. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, it's nature that offers the unexpected for Ken McGoy. And we'll end the night with Vicky Penny and a comment she did not see coming. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with J.B. Hogan as his brother surprises him in a way he'll never forget in A Small Concussion.
The Fayetteville Boys Club gym and the Arkansas National Guard Army was so bright coming in out of the late December night, I had to squint to see. It was warm inside and made me feel sleepy. I tagged along behind my brother Joe as we walked along the side of the basketball court. Out in the middle of the court was the boxing ring set up for tonight's fights. There were fold-out chairs on three sides of the ring and there was a good crowd already. We looked for our brother Bill, but it wasn't his fight yet. Bill was a really good boxer. Our sister, Martha, kept a scrapbook and had pasted in it all the newspaper clippings about his boys' club and Golden Gloves fights. The stories like to mention that he would smile at his opponents when they hit him real hard. They said it was like he was showing the other guy that whatever he hit him with, it didn't hurt him. Joe and I worked our way to some seats about three rows back where he had a good look at the ring. The other fight was in the third and final round and was a pretty good one, but we were all excited for it to get over and for Bill's to start. Lately, Bill had had some trouble because in one fight, he had taken too many punches and had what our doctor said was a small concussion. Our mother wanted him to stop fighting till he got completely well, but he wouldn't have any of that. That would have been too sissy, he said. So he kept fighting with his head hurt, and Mom had asked me and Joe to go tonight to make sure Bill was okay and come home with him after the fight. After a few minutes break, it was time for Bill's fight. The first round went okay. He moved in and out, kept his left jab in the guy's face, bobbed, weaved, landed a few good rights. The other guy stayed with him pretty well, even landing a pretty good left hook, which brought Bill's famous "you didn't hurt me" smile to his face. All in all, it was a good round, with Bill maybe taking it 10-9 if you were judging on the 10-point must system. But in the second, all heck broke loose. They had fought about a minute into the round when the other guy managed to slip in a hard jab followed by a really strong left hook. We were expecting Bill to get that smile on his face again and punch his way out of trouble, but what happened caught everyone, especially the guy in the ring with him, off guard. The guy's punches must have hurt Bill's head, hurt his concussion. You could see the pain and anger in his eyes, and then they glazed over, real scary-like, and he went after the guy like a mad animal or something. Bill threw shot after shot, left jabs, uppercuts, a whistling left hook that dropped the guy. The ref had to push Bill away to do the count. The other boy got up at 8, let the ref wipe off his gloves, and then it started again. Bill flew at him and knocked the guy's mouthpiece out. He slumped over, but Bill held him up and kept slugging until the ref got between them. Bill lunged forward anyway and knocked the guy down. The guy barely beat the 10 count, and the ref had to push Bill away again to keep him from hitting the boy when he was down. Bill's very first punch after the count rocked the guy again, and he feebly tried to cover up. Bill cut loose with everything he had, lefts, rights, uppercuts, jabs, hooks. Finally, the other guy stumbled, fell backwards, and for just a second, one of his knees grazed the canvas. In his mad way, Bill kept slugging the boy so hard that he drove him right through the ropes and out of the ring onto the first row of spectators. The place went wild. At first, the ref held up Bill's hand, ruling it a TKO. Bill's seconds rushed into the ring and led him back to his corner. The other guy's people helped him back into the ring. He had no idea where he was. Then something started happening. The ref was talking to the judges. You couldn't hear them, but you knew something was up and that it probably wouldn't be good. The ref hollered something over to Bill's corner that really got his seconds stirred up. Then the ref went over to the other boy's corner and held up his hand in victory. The crowd booed. The other boy was still out of it. But Bill, even in his blinding pain, understood he'd been disqualified for hitting the guy when he was down. As the crowd got quieter, you could hear Bill yelling at the ref. He was cussing. Now, I'd heard my brother cuss before. When I was 5, he was poking holes in the lid of a can and put an ice pick right through that fleshy web between your thumb and forefinger. I heard plenty of bad words that time, let me tell you, but they were nothing compared to what he put together now. Swearing at the top of his voice and pointing at the ref and at the beat-up guy, Bill was hustled out of the ring by his seconds before he got himself in big trouble. I remember watching them lead him away from the ring, away from me and Joe, out across the gym floor. At the end of the gym closest to us, there was a stairway that led to a locker room. His seconds took him towards the stairs as fast as they could. All the while, Bill kept up his cussing. For a moment, when they got to the stairway and helped him up to the second floor, you couldn't hear anything. When they reappeared, he was still yelling at the ref, and he kept it up until they got him into the locker room. In the excitement, I somehow lost Joe. I remember staring at the closed locker room door up on the second floor. I had never seen anything like that in my life, either the fight or what happened after it. A couple of minutes later, Joe just sort of reappeared at my side. "Come on," he said, "let's go." "We're not going to watch any more fights?" I asked stupidly. "No, come on." "We gonna tell Mom?" I asked. "Tell her what?" Joe said, frowning. "Besides, she's at work." "Oh yeah," I said. "You ain't gonna say nothing about what happened, are you?" he asked. "Heck no," I said. "I won't." "Okay, let's go home." "Ain't we gonna wait for Bill?" "No, he's too mad for that. We better stay out of his way." "Oh," I said. Outside it was very dark and the cold wind whipped right through our worn jackets. We hustled away from town and down the big hill that bottomed out 3 or 4 blocks from our home. I remember having this empty feeling in me as we walked home. I had never felt that way before, and it made me want to walk faster in the chill night air. I was glad Joe was with me, and I hung by his side, quiet, hurrying my steps to keep up, not saying anything else, not one word, all the rest of the way home.
J.B. Hogan is an award-winning fiction writer, poet, and local historian. He has published over 250 stories and poems and 3 books. His latest book is Living Behind Time. He lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Next on Tales from the South, it's what Ken McGoy can't see that scares him in A Willy Weekend.
Randy, my best friend and connection to the group, was the last in line on my left as I sloshed slowly toward him. Getting closer, I saw him playing a speckled trout, his first. Continuing on, I watched the catching, as that's just what you do. Randy reached with his net and began to scoop up under the speck when it appeared someone dropped a Volkswagen in the water he was netting. The water all around him just exploded. And so began our annual fishing trip in the Chandelure Islands about 2 weeks pre-Hurricane Katrina. The Chandelures are a small, boomerang-shaped chain of uninhabited Barrier Islands, about an hour and 30 seaplane minutes east of New Orleans. This was the fifth or sixth consecutive summer for the owners of Southern Seaplane out of Belle Chasse, Louisiana, to sponsor our trip. It was kind of a Willie Nelson weekend. I gotta get drunk and sure do dread it. Wrapped around some serious redfish and speckled trout fishing. The 11 of us, 10 Cajuns and me, met at the Southern Seaplane hangar around noon Friday. By the time we knocked the dust off a year's worth of happenings, loaded and planed, it was usually around 3 when we arrived at the Islander, our home for the weekend. The Islander was a huge barge, tight boat, made to cater and sleep 30-plus fishermen. The huge front porch served as the gathering place for everyone that wasn't sleeping or fishing. Starting at about mid-afternoon, the grill constantly fired off some smoked whatever from the day's catch. Our bill of fare was always fresh blue crabs Friday night and turducken Saturday night. Never did quite figure out how to crack crabs fast enough to satisfy my hunger. The Islander furnished flat bottoms with 10 horsepower motors for getting to our fishing spots. We motored close to where we wanted to fish, dropped anchor, then sloshed over to the spot. Sloshing is kind of like cross-country skiing, but in mud with no skis or poles. Sloshing to keep from stepping on stingrays. We usually kicked off the Friday fishing at the hot spot of the previous year, our starting spot this year about 400 yards from the Islander. We pulled alongside one of our flat bottoms, four of our guys already there. My three fishing buds jumped out and headed to the spot, kind of splaying out as they sloshed over. I lagged behind finishing a beer, that Willie thing. By the time I finished, everyone was lined up about a first down or so apart, standing in about mid-thigh to waist-deep water. As I was sloshing over, about midway there, the explosion occurred. Randy threw his rod, then fell underwater, backing away, his upper body going faster than his feet. He came up spitting water, scratching, clawing at the muddy bottom, trying to gain purchase, kind of running, falling in place. As I was processing all this, he caught traction and headed back toward me, pushing a sizable wave. He passed by, headed toward our flat bottom, mumbling something about a shark. I heard 5 or 6 feet long, the wave growing. Enough for me. I followed in behind, drafting in his wake. He beat me back to our boat, but not by much. Another beer, just him and me. No one else seemed to care. It was fishing, after all, and fishing trumps most everything, including fear and common sense. The other guys were catching them handily. It was more than Randy could stand. He picked up his extra rig and went back to fishing. Same spot. I stayed in the boat and motored over to where I was in line with the others, but, and more importantly, in the boat where I stayed the rest of the afternoon. Nothing else out of the ordinary happened that afternoon. If you can call 7 guys standing in waist or deeper, brackish water, knowing there was a 6-foot hungry shark cruising around, ordinary. I did somehow manage to catch the rod and reel he threw at the shark, the same one he's now saying he just dropped. No harm, just all the line gone off the reel. After Randy's rehashing the shark incident many times that night, on the front porch, along with some ice chest added embellishments, come Saturday, we were all on high shark alert. Judging from the response the day before, nothing would be done differently. We were just on high alert. At noon, one of the groups reported in that something bumped up against one of them hard enough to knock him off balance. His fishing bud said you could hear him screaming underwater. And he sounded pretty much like a girl. Saturday afternoon, my gang of 4 decided to go outside the protection of the islands and fish in the surf. On one of my casts, the line kept spooling off the reel, which just can't happen. After a few seconds of watching the line spool out, I stopped it with my hand. After briefly contemplating the world's longest cast ever, I began reeling in. In my peripheral, I noticed my fishing buds on either side were pointing my direction and yelling. Through the wind and waves, I managed to make out, "Ken, a fin is headed toward you." And there it was, out in the surf, gently rolling up and down with the waves, maybe saving energy, as his shore lunch was now frozen in place. Why hurry? My first thought was, "Oh, shoot," or something like that. Then, I won't get to see my daughter graduate from college, get married. If I'm not at home to intercept the credit card bill, my wife will figure out just how much this trip really cost. During all this, I continued fishing, reeling in, jigging the line, that fear and common sense thing, the fin getting closer and closer, its lunch still frozen in place. At some point, it occurred to me the fin only came toward me when I reeled in. I would say, upon closer inspection, but I don't know how I could have focused on it any more than I already was. I figured out it was a seagull's wing, jutting upward, looking just like a shark fin. Somehow, my jig and the gull had gotten tangled up in the world's longest cast. All this thinking I'm having to do, I wonder what Willie would think. And no harm this time either, just a really ticked off gull. Sunday morning, our gang was going to our last spot of the trip. We motored till the water was just over ankle deep, anchored, then sloshed over to where the water deepened to fish. Similar setting as Friday afternoon, the gang all splaying out as they sloshed on to where they wanted to start, and me lagging behind again. Not finishing a beer this time. I'd already done my part, which was documentable, by the way. Just moving real, real slow. This time fishing in mid-chest water. Randy netting his first fish when, bam, the VW again. No one said a word. Just immediately started back to the flat bottom. Randy leading the pack, pushing a wave you could surf on with the other two drafting. All three passed me as if I were backing up. For the rest of the morning, we all fished in our boat in a hole we'd never fished before in water too deep to wade. We caught the biggest we had ever caught and had two more shark incidents. It was pretty much unanimous that watching a shark attack a fish was much more pleasant when viewed from a boat. Viewing from the boat downward, we were able to see that the explosion part happens when the shark shifts gears into full tilt boogie as it's making its final approach. Truly something to see. In the previous 4 or 5 years, we had never seen a shark inside the islands. We decided that the sharks knew something was up weather-wise, or another explanation went something like, Randy had had a bit of a run-in with a Miss Kitty on Bourbon Street the night before our trip, and there was a lingering scent issue. All considered, I think Willie would have been proud.
Ken McGoy lives here in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Born in Magnolia, Arkansas, many, many years ago, Ken has one wife, one daughter, and two dogs. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Vicky Penny hears an unexpected line, and it's on in Oh No, She Didn't.
Oh no, she didn't just say that. My brain screamed, tell me she didn't. I spun quickly around to face her. She stood, stammering through an awkward apology. A young 20-something with too much makeup, too many tattoos, too many colors in her hair, and worst of all, with a body that was way too perky. I noted the fear in her eyes as strong as the anger in mine. The heads of the other patrons were turning, angling for a better view. Dang, I thought, can't kill her. There'd be too many witnesses. On second thought, no jury would dare convict me. I weighed my options carefully. I hadn't asked for this confrontation. In fact, my day had started perfectly fine. And a perfectly fine ending to a perfectly fine day would include a trip to one of my favorite restaurants on the border. The loaded cheese dip and the plate of carne asada tacos would always satisfy my Tex-Mex cravings. My husband, Wes, and I loaded up our two boys in the family car and headed out on our quest. As the only female in the household, life can be a lot like living in a frat house. I wouldn't know what to do with the remote. I haven't seen one in years. And I'm the only one in the house who doesn't giggle at the bodily noises emanating at will from the pack. At the eatery, the hostess gave us a choice of table or booth. All parents understand that when your children are of a certain age, you always pick the booth. We call it containment theory. We settled in our brightly colored bench seats, my husband and I sitting across from each other, each one with one child pinned between us and the wall, the yellow and red sconce of the Aztec sun smiling down from above and adhered to the broad swaths of color on the walls, giving the impression of a quaint Mexican village whose citizens had way too much time, tequila, and primary colors. The meal was as good as promised. I mean, we had a lovely waiter who frequented our table and assessed our drink status and food satisfaction. In fact, even our children had been mannerly, choosing to use the utensils provided instead of fingers. That in and of itself is a miracle. All in all, an entirely hassle-free family outing. What a perfect end to a perfect day. Then it came time to leave. Wes, being the gentleman that he is, held his hand out to me. Gently, he took my hand in his and guided me from my seat. A waitress approached from behind me and said in the direction of my husband, "Aw, I do that for my mom, too." I snapped my body around to face her. She was shrinking before my eyes. Both of her hands were up in a defensive position. Words tumbled out of her mouth in some pitiful excuse for an apology. Time slowed as I formulated my plan of attack. I was focused and began to shorten the distance between she and me. It was not just me I was standing up for. No, this would be for all the middle-aged women in the world. All of us who have been forced from the young and hip crowd into the world of older, wiser classification simply because of the numbers depicted on our driver's license and the lines on our faces. For all those times of being out in public with our children and someone saying, "Your grandchildren are so cute." I could take her down with one strike. One blow is all it would take. I became distracted by movement out of the corner of my eye. In that instant, my husband had blocked me from my intended victim. His eyes locked on mine. Quietly, he whispered to me, whoa, look around you. I gazed across the cozy room. All eyes were on me. No one wanted to miss this show. Even my boys were sitting rock still with their eyes on me. I was making a scene I had been forced into facing, not one I had willingly created. But for humanity's sake, I must handle this as a grown-up, you know, set the example for my young men to follow. They must understand that in situations such as this, violence is not the answer. No matter how every fiber of your being is waiting to act, after all, what separates Homo sapiens from the other creatures of the earth? Defeated, I took a deep breath, turned, and walked briskly in the direction of the door. Again, Wes moved ahead of me and pushed to open it. I smiled at the thought of how lucky I was to have married such a wise gentleman. He would be the example I hoped our boys would follow. Then he smirked and said, "Come on, Mama. I'll take you back to the home now." And my boys laughed.
Vicki Taylor Penny and her family reside in Northwest Arkansas, where she enjoys sharing stories with family and friends. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Maxine's Tap Room in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Brighter accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.